Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Good morning, everyone. Hello. G'day and welcome to the Sydney Writers' Festival. My name is Benjamin Law, and what a privilege it is to be here with you this morning, and what a privilege it is to be here with you on Gadigal land. First Nations Australians like the Gadigal of the great Eora Nation where we are now, which spans the Sydney Basin, have been making art and sharing stories and knowledge here for tens of thousands of years, at least 65,000 years in fact, and together they constitute the longest continuing human civilization on the planet. As a non-Indigenous Australian, I'm especially grateful to Elders past and present that we can continue telling stories here on Aboriginal land. And as we know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are telling some of the most important and urgent stories right now. And we're lucky to have the likes of Evelyn Araluen, Tony Birch, Melissa Lukashenko, Alison Whitaker, Stan Grant, Nayuka Gori. I could go on as part of the program, so make sure that you seek them out. Now, some of you are here today because you already know that our guest this morning has written one of the finest novels of the past few years. I'm a voracious reader, but I have to say even I sometimes struggle to find that book that I call a phone killer, one of those books that is just so compelling that you actually forget that your smartphone even exists. And since finishing this book, I've been aggressively thrusting it into people's faces, telling them to read it. Sorry, I used to be a bookseller and I had that trick that I wanted to do to brand the book properly. There we go. There we go. And I have to say that I am one of those people that rarely cries when reading books. That's not because I'm dead inside, but it's a rare thing for me to have an emotional response like I did. When I closed this book's final pages, I burst into tears and rolled onto my partner's chest, and he was partly concerned and partly invested in prying the book off my hands so he could read it himself. The Great Believers is a novel told in two strands. One strand is set in mid-1980s Chicago, where the HIV/AIDS epidemic is crescendoing. And the other strand is set in present-day Paris, following a woman whose life is still shaped and permanently transformed by her experiences of that previous era. Since its publication, this novel has been selected as a New York Times Best 10 Books of the Year. It's won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Fiction, the Stonewall Book Award, the Andrew Carnegie Medal, and it has been shortlisted for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. It's now also set to be a major TV event with Amy Poehler optioning the screen rights. And we are so pleased and delighted to have the author here with us this morning at the Sydney Writers Festival. Please welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival, and in fact, Sydney, Australia, Rebecca Mackay.
Thank you.
Rebecca, The Great Believers is such a convincing novel that depicts an era and a specific community. We're talking about Chicago, we're talking about Boys Town, the gay district there. And these characters are so fleshed out. And I was absolutely shocked after reading it to Google you and to find you wrote it. You know, this young woman who would have been, what, seven-ish years old when this novel begins. So for you as a writer, why this era? Why AIDS era Chicago, and why this book now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think when I speak to people who are just about exactly my age, gay or straight, there is a sort of a generational touchstone there. People exactly my age completely understand why I was drawn to the subject, where for us, whether or not we were directly affected, it was looming as the largest thing in the world in our childhoods. Not every adult understood that. Mm. I think adults had a sense of crises coming and going. Adults had a sense of that's happening to those people over there. And adults had their own issues to deal with, their own lives. Kids, and remember this was at a time when kids would watch the news, which I don't think they do. You know, my kids don't watch the news now. Mm. Or you'd stay home sick from school and watch a talk show, and you'd see these things being debated. It was so clear to me as a child that this was the most important thing happening in the world. The fact that people slightly older than me, people younger than me who never knew it have moved on, baffles me. This seemed very obvious thing to be drawn to write about.
We're roughly of the same generation, and if you grew up of our generation in the Australian context, you might have heard of the Grim Reaper ads, where there was a TV campaign where basically there was the Grim Reaper rolling a bowling ball, knocking down people with HIV, AIDS, that essentially, I kind of feel like we were the first generation where right from childhood, sex more broadly, but especially same-sex relations were pathologized, that sex was very keenly associated with death. Did you feel that?
Yeah, absolutely. We did not have... Those ads sound a little bit terrifying. Mm. What's more terrifying is that we didn't have any ads.
Right.
We didn't have any of that stuff. There were, maybe posters, in the college dorm, that kind of thing, but there was very, very little going on. And Ronald Reagan did not say the word AIDS in public until 1987, when there were tens of thousands of people dead. And for that reason, America lost more people faster. It spread faster. It was less controlled because there was such lack of education and such stigma around all of it. The other thing that happened to my generation is we got to high school in the early 90s, and depending on the kind of school you went to and where it was. But for me, it was, almost all of my sex ed in high school was HIV/AIDS in a very responsible way, fortunately. It was a lot about, no, don't worry, you can't get it from this. Everyone should get tested, everyone should use protection. But it continued, it was the global thing, along with, I think, the Ethiopian famine that I really was latched onto as a kid. And then it became, right at the time that we were going through adolescence, becoming, entering the sexual world, it was there looming as well.
So that's the place in which it occupied your imagination growing up. What about now as an adult writer writing in the 2010s? Why this particular period? Why the propulsion to write this novel now?
Yeah, I came to the book very sideways. There is in the book now a subplot about a woman who had been an artist's model in 1910s Paris. The novel started off about her.
Oh.
And I had this idea. I wanted to write about a woman who had been an artist's muse back at a time when women didn't have the resources to make their own art. What would that mean if being a muse was your art? Since my previous novel had been historical, I really didn't want to write another historical novel. Whoops. So I thought, okay, no, I'm going to set it at the end of her life, looking back. Mathematically, that put her in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I grew up in the 80s. I won't have to do research. It'll be easier. I quickly, lot of twists and turns of what happened to me in terms of in the year or so that I was spinning the story around mentally before I started to tell it. One thing that happened was that originally the idea was going to be that the real beginning of the story was going to be that she was watching the news, and a painting was going to come up on the news as having been recently discovered. And there was a question as to its authenticity. Was it really by this famous painter? And she knew that it was because that was a painting of her. Mm. So she's trying to contact people in the art world. And I'd been thinking about this quite a long time. And I mentioned to my husband what I was thinking. And he very sweetly goes, honey, that's the plot of the movie Titanic. Where there's that sketch, and she's like, "That's me," and I. So that really threw me for a loop. But I was already thinking about the art guy that she'd be in conversation with, and had already, I'd long been interested in writing about the AIDS epidemic, and in my previous book, which was a short story collection, there was a short story about AIDS in New York. So I'd figured, okay, maybe AIDS will be a subplot here. Uh-huh. As I rethought everything, and as I started researching both eras, both 1920s Art World Paris, about which it was very easy to find information, and the world of AIDS in Chicago in the 1980s, about which there was virtually no information in print form or in film form, I found myself, first of all, finding fascinating parallels between the two times. Mm. The generation that was, of young people from all over the world who had gone to Paris, to the art academies, that generation then being decimated by World War I and by the influenza of 1918, which largely in both cases took the young able-bodied men. Mm. And the period afterwards, which is when the American writers like Hemingway and Fitzgerald go over to Paris, that's when Gertrude Stein says to them, "You're all a lost generation." Mm. And the parallels between that time and the AIDS generation in a city like Chicago, again, coming there from all over, finding chosen family, finding some semblance of happiness, and then this this epidemic rolling through and the aftermath of that, those parallels became really striking to me. And I think because the research about Chicago, I think for one thing because it was harder won, mm-hmm. it became more compelling to me. And it just felt, as I wrote, as I researched, as I plotted, felt like that was the emotional weight of the book. The problem was that I found myself writing a novel about AIDS and was terrified about appropriation, about writing across difference, about threading that needle, which is a very small needle to thread. That's not something that you can mess up on.
I want to talk more about that research process soon. The two kind of dual hearts of this story are the main characters of Yale and Fiona. Yale is the art dealer that you talk about early on. And I think it would be so fascinating to, especially like anyone who's read this book, that it actually started with the Muse character, who's very much a pivotal character in this book. But then, of course, Yale really becomes the center, and then Fiona, who occupies the present day thread of the story. Can you tell us a little bit about those characters and what was the seed for each of them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started off writing the book only about this man, Yale. It was going to be basically his point of view. He's the art guy that this old woman is in contact with. He's hearing her story. He's living through his own crisis. I put him I changed the name so that no one can possibly figure out that the art gallery at Northwestern University is the art gallery at Northwestern University, because I changed the name from Block to Brig. But I did that because some untoward things happened there between professors and students. So I didn't want to, I couldn't be writing about an actual gallery director. But I put him up there, slightly, newer to the city, slightly outside of the city, but still very central. Someone who was, had just kind of really had found himself, was new to this new job. Things are going very well as his personal life is falling apart around him. I needed to give him an arc as well that was separate from the arc of the disease. Mm. And so I really needed to think about what his journey was in terms of growth, where his life was taking on value and meaning, even as his life was also falling apart. So he was challenging to write, but he was, very close to me. I was very fond of him as I wrote.
And so you've got, as your starting points, you've got 1920s Paris, and you've got 1980s Chicago. At what point did you realize that 2015 Paris needed to be part of this too?
It was a couple different things. On the one hand, I was quite panicked about, and I think for good reason, I think there's a healthy terror about appropriation and about whether, if I wrote only from Yale's point of view, did it feel like an attempt at ventriloquism in some way, rather than a broad polyphonic novel. And so I was thinking at that point about broadening things. Did I want other voices? Did I want more texture here so it didn't feel like I'm being him? Rather, I'm the novelist up somewhere on the hill, and I'm putting together this whole world. The more compelling thing for me was that because there was so little, there was nothing literally that I could find in book form about Chicago at that time. Most of my research was archival, and more so was interviews. Mm. I ended up talking to doctors, nurses, lawyers, activists, journalists, historians, survivors, and I became really fascinated in those conversations with the 30-year gap. I psychologically fascinated with the long arm of grief. Mm. And, what happens when you were given a death sentence 30 years ago and you're still here.
Yeah.
What happens when you lost all of your friends in your 20s and you're the only survivor? There was a conversation I had with someone at one point where he was talking about a friend of his who'd been very dear to him, someone quite prominent, so he was in a position often of talking about this guy. And he stopped himself mid-thought and he said, you know, he said, I always feel really guilty when I talk about Danny because we were close, but we were friends in our 20s, and if he'd lived, we would have drifted apart, and he would have just been another friend from my 20s. But because he died, I have kept talking about him for 30 years, and I don't feel like I deserve that. Mm. It was such a strange, complicated thought that I think I'm still unpacking. But that became, you know, what happens to you in the long run became really compelling to me. So I knew that I wanted someone demographically different from Yale, and I mm-hmm. knew that I wanted someone in what was then the present day, although now 2015 feels like ages.
Sure.
A lot has happened.
But it also sounds like, so part of the motivation is what I'm hearing, that you didn't want to necessarily write a novel that looked at a part of history but relegated it to the mists of time.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things that I really love about this book is... the cast of characters around Yale and Fiona. Mm-hmm. There are so many of them, and I'm guessing that they came from the research process?
Yeah, I never based a character on a real person, with the exception of the mayor of Chicago. That's the one real sure. character in there. And that was something that was important to me, to be able to go into these interviews and say, I have my characters, I'm set, I just need... you know, textural detail, I need emotional research. Don't worry that I'm going to base a character on you or your friend that you're telling me about. So, you know, I think in fiction as in dreaming, what a psychiatrist would say is every character is actually you in some way. But in terms of, little tiny details, those certainly, you know, those characters became more and more fleshed out by the conversations I was having with people. But I had more of a mandate than usual not to put any actual real detail mm-hmm. into my characters. You know, if someone said I waited tables at this restaurant, I'm not going to have a character wait tables at that restaurant.
Sure.
So, yeah.
I mean, it really is such a beautiful cast of characters. I think, you know, as you read this novel, I mean, I personally wanted to be around them. I wanted to probably make out with some of them as well. And just to give us a taste of who these people are, can I ask you to read from some of the book? And who are these characters that you're going to introduce us to?
Yeah, I'm going to... this is about Julian. And Julian is one of my favorite characters.
Yes.
He was someone who... I started off the book writing, it started at a party scene, which if you're going to write a book, don't ever start with a party scene. It's really a headache. But he kind of showed up at this party. I just needed people to populate the party. And he showed up and he was kind of silly and fun and really became one of my favorite, he's my favorite minor character. Mm. And Yale is in this scene too. I'm reading from quite far on, but there's really not much of a spoiler here. He is an actor. He has found out, and this is the one spoiler, although if you've started it, this shouldn't be a shock. He's found out, he's taken the test, which had recently become available, and found out that he's HIV positive, and he's not handling it well. He's shaved his head, he's camping at various houses at various times, and he has this plan, sort of hiding at Yale's apartment. His plan is to take off for Puerto Rico so he can die in peace away from everyone else. Two things you need to know. One is that Yale is, for reasons I'm not going to explain, staying in an apartment that's owned by a couple named the Sharps. It's, if you've ever been to Chicago or seen pictures, there are these two sort of corncob-shaped towers, and he's in one of those. And the other is that there's always been this rumor that when Julian was younger, he worked at Disneyland, and the rumor is that he played Prince Charming. He's very good-looking. So I'll read, it's basically a page and a half. Does it
great.
Sound good? Okay.
Sounds great.
Okay. They ate pizza and drank beer at the dining table. Oh, by the way, if there are any children in the room, please cover their ears. This is really inappropriate for 10 in the morning. and turned off the lights so they could look out the windows at the city. Julian said, this is like the Jetsons, like a flying car should pick you up outside your window. It had been nearly 2 weeks since Julian had shaved his head, and at least you couldn't see white patches anymore. Still, it was all wrong. His ears stuck out. His forehead looked broad and pale. Yale said, "I want you to know I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at the world, I'm mad at the government, but you're hard to be mad at." It's because I'm so pitiful. No, really, it is. I've learned this recently. When you're a sad sack of shit, no one feels anything for you but pity. "I don't think you're pitiful," Yale said. "Just wait till I weigh 80 pounds. I mean, you won't ever see that, because I'll be gone. That's my point. I hate being pitied. I wish you'd just be mad at me. I wish you'd kick me in the head. No one's willing to be mad at me but God." "For Christ's sake," Yale said. "You can stay over, but Jerry Falwell can't, okay?" Jerry, if you don't know, he was this horrible, horrible political,
evangelical,
religious guy.
Anti-gay dude.
Yeah. "I can't shake the feeling that God chased me up here from Georgia. I tried to make my life perfect, and I came up here, and everything was beautiful. It was so good, and I should have known. I should have been waiting for this." "I understand, but that's, you're internalizing a lot of bullshit." "Did I ever tell you about Disney World? Not when I worked there, the first time I went." Yale said no, got them more beer. "They have this thing called Grad Night, where they keep the park open all night long for kids about to graduate high school. And Valdosta's right across the border, so the Parents Association got us buses and bought us all tickets. You could go on any ride, no lines, and you just had to stay awake all night. Everyone had a flask. And at first, I was sticking with my friends, all these theater girls who thought they were going to marry me. And then I start noticing these three guys from some other school, so beautiful and so gay, like dripping with gay, which wasn't something I'd really seen in Georgia. We're waiting behind them for Space Mountain, and one of them, this kid with an earring, starts talking to me and says they're getting food. Do I want food? So by the time we get off the ride, I'm following these guys, eating ice cream with them, and my friends are gone. And the guy with the earring wants us to do the people mover. It's not even a ride, really. It's like you go in this little box along an elevated track, but slow. So his friends go in one car, and he and I go in the next one, even though we could have squeezed together. And at this point in my life, just being in the same space as this guy is the most thrilling thing I've ever done. I'm terrified. So the ride goes through some buildings, and at one point it goes into the dark. And it's only supposed to be a few seconds, but the ride gets stuck there, in the dark. Everyone's shouting and laughing. Yale wasn't sure if the story was about to turn pornographic or romantic or terrible, so he just said, "Oh God," which covered all three possibilities. "What did you do?" "Nothing. The kid got down on his knees and unzipped my fly and sucked me off. It was the most amazing 2 minutes of my life. I mean, I was terrified they would turn on the lights, but I didn't really have much mental space for that. The ride started moving again like half a second after I zipped back up." "That's, wow." "Well, yeah. And my takeaway from the whole thing, besides the fact that I was definitely gay, was that there were good places and bad places in the world. Disney World was a good place, and Valdosta was a bad place, and I had to get back to Disney as fast as I could, which I did. And then after a couple years, it was about getting to a real city. So I tried Atlanta, and then it was about getting out of the South, getting to a bigger city, a bigger theater scene. Like, the more steps I took away from Valdosta, the safer I'd be. It was a ladder that just went up and up and up, right? And it ended in some kind of mansion in San Francisco. But look at me. I feel like such an idiot that I ever thought I could have a really good life." Yale said, "You'll have a better life if you stay here than if you go. You need to stay where people love you. Aren't you falling into the same trap again, thinking there's some better place out there?" "I mean, there are warmer places. I'll say that. If I'm gonna die, I wanna die with the sun shining on my face." "Fair enough." Yale made sure Julian had towels in the master bathroom. He imagined the Sharps coming home next month to find an entire 58th floor refugee camp of the recently diagnosed. Sleeping bags and cots, vitamins and protein shakes.
Rebecca Mackay, everyone. Rebecca, you really make us fall in love with these characters. And of course, the really painful thing for a reader is seeing some of these characters lost to us.
Right.
And that's a difficult thing to experience on the page, but it's flagged right from the start that this is what's going to happen. I'm wondering how difficult that was for you as a writer to do.
That's a good question. And yeah, it went beyond just needing to do terrible things to characters who I've become very attached to, which is always hard. And I've dealt with that before. I had characters in my second novel who died as well. But in particular, here was the really messed up thing. The people I was writing about and their real life corollaries, whom I was interviewing, had railed against the concept that there was some force out there in the universe deciding who lived and who died according to some kind of moral or ethical or logical criteria.
But now suddenly as a writer, you need to be a force that decides that.
Exactly, yeah. I was playing God in this universe. I was this person. And on the one hand, I needed to get across the random brutality of this disease. It can't be logical who lives and who dies. But at the same time, in fiction, you have to look for threads of cause and effect. It can't just be chaos within your book, right? Mm. And so I felt at a certain point like there was no way that I could have a character who was infected. There was no way that they could have gotten sick that didn't feel like a judgment from me, the author, or like a judgment from the universe. Mm. And I ultimately what I did is I wrote that frustration into the book. There's a character named Teddy who has sort of a rant at one point about if you got it from sleeping with one person once, that's like a judgment on the act itself. If you got it from sleeping with a lot of people, that's like a judgment on promiscuity. And if you got it because you thought you couldn't, you know, that's kind of me going, there is no possible way to start these chains of cause and effect that does not feel like some judgment. But I think that so often the solution to, you know, crises in writing is to write the crisis into the book.
Yeah.
So that's all I could do.
I mean, this book isn't, say, a thriller, but plot-wise, there are, like, still so many moments in this book where I audibly gasped because there are twists in the plot which are shocking, but then you realise they're so inevitable because they've actually been planted, like, right from the first chapter. And I'm wondering, in terms of craft and structure, how you actually make those mechanisms. Are you surprising yourself as you write the book, or actually are you planning this right from the start in order to bring us back to that party where everything is set in motion?
Yeah, no. There are layers upon layers upon layers, right? The way that a painter might paint and add different things at different times. The first chapter of the book it feels at first almost like a set piece, like it's going to be sort of its own encapsulated thing. It's a it's a party where it's a memorial party, but some very strange things happen. And I think it's tempting to read it, and I know I put it right out there, it's tempting to read it sort of as an allegory or as, you know, a presage of what's to come. I really needed it to be tied in fundamental ways to the rest of what happens. And so going back in revision and revising, outlining, re-outlining, re-revising, you know, you get to the point where you're planting things.
Yeah.
Planting seeds that you know you'll harvest later. But it's weird because you already have the tree and now I'm going back and putting the seed that it already grew from.
You mentioned before that there is a kind of an absence of literature about this particular period, about this particular phenomenon of predominantly men dying, gay men dying during this era, and particularly in Chicago. At the same time, I think there are those bigger, broader cultural touchstones about HIV/AIDS this crisis in America. I'm wondering, like, two things. What were those touchstones for you when you came into this book? And also, what accounts for the absence about this particular world that you're writing about?
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because I don't want to discount. There is some amazing art and literature and theater about AIDS. I'm very aware of it. It's tremendously inspirational. Angels in America by Tony Kushner has been an inspiration in all of my writing, not just in this book. And I could go on and on. That said, relatively speaking, there's very little. And I keep getting asked in interviews about, you know, what do you think about this wave of AIDS literature? And I'm like, you mean the three novels or so that have kind of done well in the past 5 years? You know, I think that, and not that there's too much of it by a long shot, there needs to be, but you think about how many books are coming out each year still about, say, the Holocaust. You know, and in comparison, globally, we've lost about 45 million people to AIDS. There are about 1 million dying still per year, largely in Africa. It's being ignored largely because of, you know, for racist reasons, among other things. And so it's just, you know, it kills me when people are going, why did you think of writing about that? Because, you know, you would never ask me that if I'd written about World War II, which I also wasn't there for and wasn't a part of, you know. But that said, so I think that at the time that it was happening, I think two things were occurring. One was it was a very hard time to get anything LGBTQ published at all, if not from a niche LGBTQ press, which would then only be carried in LGBTQ bookstores,
yes.
Right? Also at the time, you know, it's very hard to write about a crisis from the middle of it. You know, if you look at Holocaust literature, most of it was coming out 20, 30 years, some, you know, the big books after the Holocaust. People were not writing Holocaust literature in the concentration camps necessarily, right? Yeah. So I think for someone to process what happened, to see the implications of it, there were things. Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart came out, you know, right in the midst of things. There were things happening. There was some great visual art that came out right at that time in response. But I think that hopefully we're at a time when we have the opportunity to be publishing, promoting, writing, you know, doing these things while the people who were most affected by it, those survivors, are still with us, whether to make that art themselves or to, you know, be there for us to listen to.
You mentioned that one of your anxieties before coming into this was the perils of appropriation,
yes.
Ventriloquism, and to address that, you leaned into research. You
yes.
had a lot of conversations. Now that this book is out, what has the response been, more broadly from the LGBTIQA plus community,
yeah.
but also specifically the community that you're writing about?
Yeah.
How have they come to the book?
It's been beyond my dreams. I've been so completely grateful. I had one Twitter troll.
Okay.
He's kind of shut up now.
Right.
So, a young guy who didn't live through it, you know.
Is that a form of flattery then?
I think, yeah, I don't know. I think that there's certainly, and I was anticipating much more of this, there's certainly people going, that's not the book for me, I'd rather read a direct account, in which case, yes, you should. Please make sure you actually aren't just saying that, but that you do it.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite event that I did was at the Howard Brown Health Center in Chicago, which is written about in my book, is still continuing as a, health and crisis center for LGBTQIA and at-risk kids, and then for adults as well. It was an audience of almost entirely men in their 60s,
mm-hmm.
you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, with a few younger people mixed in. And the support in that room was so completely overwhelming, and people were bringing me photographs, and just, you know, it was just amazing. I think that when people get nervous about the appropriation, it's almost always much younger people. I think it's a generational thing, for one.
Yeah.
Also, it's people who are going, they're kind of worried. They're going, she wrote this. I wonder how the people who live through it are going to respond. Maybe I need to say something. But the people who actually live through it are not having that,
yeah.
Those qualms. And I think have been, for the most part, first of all, know that they might tell their own story, you know, and they're not worried about, am I usurping voice from them? They know that they can tell their own story, and are also grateful, you know, when there has been so much silence around this all along, that someone does want to write about this, someone who was a kid at the time does want to tell this story, and that I would, you know, spend the years researching and talking to them to do it.
Yeah. Fiona, the kind of present-day character of this novel, seems to me represent this walking embodiment of a nation feeling the repercussions and aftershocks of a very particular era, and how you can't really divorce yourself from personal and political trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It's been over three decades since the events that Yale and Fiona both experience in the book. Where do you feel America is at with processing and mourning and acknowledging what you write about in The Great Believers?
Yeah. I think that in terms of the gay community and the community of allies that understands the crisis and knows what's going on, you know, more resources than ever to, you know, the fact that I'm able to publish a book like this and it's from a major press and it's going in the major bookstores and it's, you know, that's something that would not have happened 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tremendous progress in many ways. There are many, many good things happening. There are good things medically happening. At the same time, I'm concerned that we are returning in many ways to the silence that originally surrounded the epidemic, largely out of ignorance, which was part of the problem to begin with. You would not believe how many times random people, as I've told them about my book, have glibly informed me that AIDS has been cured. Going, oh yeah, isn't it great that we cured it? You're like, no.
I had not heard that news.
No. They're like, yeah, no, it's cured because Magic Johnson is doing fine. It's this basketball player in America who announced his diagnosis in the early 90s and is still alive. And for apparently a huge number of Americans, is one of the only people they have ever heard of who had HIV.
Wow.
And the fact that he's still alive means to them that it's been cured. I mean, there's some profound ignorance out there. That's certainly not everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, I think, you know, what's happening now is that we do have, in America, we have about 1.1 million Americans living with HIV. Largely, you know, certainly some of that initial generation who's getting older and this really interesting new field of geriatric HIV care, which is fraught and is a great thing to be happening that, you know, people never thought they'd see this day, but there's research that needs to be done. But for the most part, it is Black and brown populations in cities like Atlanta or Washington, D.C. And I think that, you know, Originally, the willful ignorance and the dismissal of this crisis was mostly homophobia and a small part of racism. And I think that that ratio has flipped. I think that it is mostly racism at this point, and still some homophobia, but an inverse. And, I 35 million people globally living with HIV, most of them in Africa, which allows the news media allows people to feel like it's a third world problem in some way, which is, it's just blatant racism.
Well, let's talk more about the global context. The Great Believers is about to go in translation in many, many different languages.
Yeah.
As you travel the English speaking world, at least, I'm curious as to what people's reactions are and how they relate it to their own countries or regions, even in America, their experience of HIV AIDS. I mean, you're in Sydney at the moment, and this kind of really is the city where that really, it really happened here. St. Vincent's Hospital is close by where we had our first patient, diagnosed with what would later become known as HIV/AIDS. And our community's response here, our political response here, was very, very different to the American response with Reagan. So as you travel the English-speaking world, what have different responses been to the book?
That's a great question. One thing, and this was before travel, just in my research, something that was particularly devastating to me because I hadn't realized it, was how much better other places did than America. In Paris and London, which is more my context, only learning about Australia more recently, Paris and London, it hit fast, early, hard too, and they had tremendous education. There wasn't as much stigma surrounding sex and sex education and homosexuality. And they curtailed it very quickly. And most of the medical advances that were made against AIDS, especially early on, were from Paris. And it was just devastating to me to realize how utterly preventable so many of the American deaths were and how much of that was politics and dismissal and hatred, how much it literally was a Holocaust. It was a Holocaust of neglect rather than of, but people are still dead.
I mean, we're also in the era of Trump now. So in the American context, I just want to bring it back with Reagan in particular.
Yeah.
You said it wasn't until, 1987 that he even mentioned AIDS.
Yeah.
And now, because we are in an era with a very different type of presidency, Reagan is often summoned as another era of statesmanship when it comes to politics.
Right.
Are Americans, especially in the context of HIV/AIDS, starting to reassess that the statesmanship and the quality of his presidency?
I hope they are. One of the things that has been thrilling to me as this book has gone out into the world in the States is people telling me they hadn't realized that about him. Part of what the silence surrounding it was that they weren't hearing the people screaming in the wilderness either. They just weren't aware of that ignorance of what was happening. And, I'm sometimes traveling, I'm sometimes reading someplace like San Francisco, where basically everyone in the audience was directly affected by it if they're of a certain age. Sometimes I'm reading places like small city in Wisconsin, where the comments I'm getting sometimes at the end are, upper middle class women, maybe in their 60s, saying, I had no idea. that I was living in the suburbs, I was raising my kids, I had no idea. And it's in rooms like that where when I say, and often they've read the book or they've read part of it maybe and they haven't gotten so much to the Reagan stuff, but I'll say, you know, Reagan didn't say the word AIDS until 1987, and there's sort of a look of shock and devastation on some people's faces that I think might be a realization about someone that they had revered. And I think it's important for us to, you know, you can admire some things about him, that's fine, but, you know, I think it's very important to recognize how much this was preventable, how much this was antipathy that caused so much devastation. It was not some, you know, insurmountable wave of germs that came over, that there were things that we could have done.
Yeah.
What's really, I was about to say what's really weird about Trump, as if I could follow that with one sentence.
That's a whole other session.
But I'll say one thing, which is that he very quietly, between Christmas and New Year's of 2017, fired all the remaining members of the HIV/AIDS Advisory Council.
Wow.
But then very publicly, very loudly declared that he was going to make sure that AIDS was cured globally by 2020 or something like some. Yeah. So not sure how that's going to work. He also pulled out of the AIDS Global Fund in Africa, which is something that the World Health Organization predicts will probably result in about 1 million preventable deaths in the next few years.
Wow.
So, you know, there's some lip service and not much. And then the exact opposite action.
I mean, when we step back a few steps, in the Obama era, he always had that quote about, time is long, but, time bends towards justice, you know, the arc of time bends towards justice, right? How is the queer community feeling about that idea now in the era of Trump, actively going after transgender people, actively going after young queer people especially?
You know, I can't answer for them, but what I can say is that the voices of these people who I interviewed and became very close with have been what's gotten me through the last few years politically in America. I started this book in 2014 and finished it in 2017. Mm-hmm. So that was quite an interesting couple of years there. I mean, I was, you know, going out to demonstrations and then coming home to write about demonstrations from 1990. I think that there, in my limited view of, you know, the people I know who I've talked to about this, there was a mix of absolute despair over, you know, we've been here before, we've fought these fights, we made all this progress, it can be gone in a heartbeat, what did we fight for? And at the same time, often with the same people, this sense of, okay, plan B17, we know what to do, you guys. Like, let's go. We've been here. We know the drill. And
so a combination of despair and mobilization.
Yeah. Sort of, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing this again. I guess we're doing this again.
Yeah.
We know what to do. And, you know, I was, it was this moment I was out there. One of the biggest initial protests was the day after Trump's inauguration. There was a women's march, which was a lot of men as well. It really was surreal for me. I had literally been working on these chapters of the 1990 major ACT UP protest in Chicago. And I believe this chant that, as far as I know, originated with ACT UP, which was people with AIDS under attack, what do we do? ACT UP, fight back. And I'm at the Women's March, and one of the chants that goes through the crowd was, women and children under attack, what do we do? And I was like, it can't be ACT UP. Like, that's the AIDS thing. I'm just waiting for the answer. Yeah. And I can't remember what it was. It was like something, fight back. But it was an adaptation of this ACT UP, you know. So much of what we know about direct action, so much of what we know about protest in the contemporary day comes not only from certainly the civil rights movement, and I'm talking about America here, the civil rights movement, but from ACT UP. Whether people understand that lineage or not, they were literally doing, I think without knowing it, an adaptation of an ACT UP chant. And so then I was sobbing, which didn't help anything.
So not just an important historical legacy, but an important political one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well. Absolutely, yeah.
We've got about 15 minutes to hear from you guys, actually. So if you've got any questions, there are roving mics. Don't be shy, because we are not. So if you do have questions, just put up your hand up high to ask Rebecca Mackay a question about the Great Believers.
Ooh, there's one back there.
And is there a question from the cabaret seating at all? Is there any question from here? Just put up your hand and the mic will come to you.
Hello. Really great book. I inhaled it, didn't look at my phone once about the day. One of the things in the book which was interesting to me was there seems to be a parallel between Nora's story and the later young woman.
Yeah.
One's been through the post-war era and then the other's been through the AIDS Holocaust, or neglect as you call it. Mm-hmm. Were veterans groups happy with you drawing that parallel, which is quite a...
Yeah, that's okay. So yeah, I'll kind of explain the question, which is that I'm making sometimes very overt parallels to war. You know, we're talking on the one hand about the aftermath of World War I, and then we're talking about the aftermath of the AIDS epidemic. And it's at a certain point, you know, Yale says to Fiona, you know, no one's going to give you a Purple Heart, but you've been through a war. And I was really interested in that concept of you know, women being a part of aftermath, going, you know, thinking about like the Trojan Women, that ancient Greek play, right? Like that this is a common theme in world history. I will double down on any comparisons that I've made between war and the AIDS epidemic. These are people who were out in the streets fighting for their life. You know, being thrown down by police, being picked up by their necks and thrown into police vans when they were already terribly ill. They were fighting for their people, for themselves. I mean, what else is war? And I've only had one person really get upset about that parallel. It was, no one had read the book, actually. Go figure. And I had done an interview on National Public Radio in the U.S., and I was talking about that analogy, and some woman went on some random Instagram post of mine and tried to light into me, and she's like, that's awfully rich to compare, blah, blah, blah. And I just, you know, I said, here's what I mean, and then I said, you're welcome to read the book. I don't care to read your book.
Wow.
but she certainly didn't strike me as a veteran. but no, I would say, you know, certainly you're not fighting over land, but what are you fighting for? You're fighting for your life, for the lives of your people, for freedom, for safety, for, you know, it was, and when you get into activism, which is really by the end what I'm writing about, you're really writing about a war. And in the times when you're writing about survival, you're in so many ways writing about the home front, right? And the aftermath, you know, with that lost generation after World War I and the generation of survivors who lost the friends of their youth. They lost their compatriots. They were in the trenches together and they were the ones who made it out. That's war.
Thank you so much for your question. Is there another question from the floor at all? I see one there.
Hi. There's a lot of relationships around mothers, unsatisfactory mothers in particular, but kind of families with a lot of disconnect between the adult and the children at whatever age that happens. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I think it was interesting because this is, you know, a novel that's in no way autobiographical, and yet I think it was my first foray into really writing about motherhood. I have daughters, they're young, and they're lovely. They have not, no one's run away to Paris yet. You know, I think it was something that was always going to be a theme of the book, knowing that I was writing about a gay population in the 1980s. Severed families and chosen family is fundamentally going to be a part of that narrative. So when I brought Fiona back into the story, when I decided to introduce those 2015 sections, you know, she's largely there as a, you know, to register and absorb the shocks of what happened, you know, 30 years past, to be rethinking that. But I needed that trauma to travel through her life, and I needed her to have kind of forward-facing conflicts. You can't have a character who's sitting there just remembering things. I had previously been writing a short story about a young woman who had joined a cult. And I was really interested, and it didn't work as a short story, and it's very different than what I have in the book, really interested in that idea of a cult as a sort of chosen family, of the connections you sever with your actual family. And so giving Fiona, basically those of you who haven't read it, what the reason Fiona is in Paris, and the artist from the 1920s was her great aunt, so there's sort of this coming full circle. But she's trying to track down her estranged daughter who had joined a cult and then run away from the cult to Paris. It was a way of continuing with that theme and that question of what makes family, what do we owe to each other? And what do we owe to each other, by blood? What do we owe to each other through friendship? What do we owe to each other over time? You were someone's mother. Are you still their mother this far on? You were someone's friend when they were alive. Now they've been gone 25 years. Do you still own their legacy? Ultimately, among many other things, it is a book about human connection. Mm. Maybe partly in part because of where I am in my own life, that's going to be about motherhood. Mm.
There also seems to be an implicit question in Fiona's thread about how much care you can give to people before you kind of break yourself. Like, what is your capacity to care in amongst endless and seemingly relentless trauma?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that I think has been, on the one end, and again, as I introduced Fiona, it solved some problems for me, but it created others. So I was a very tremendous concern then of, am I straight washing this narrative? Am I, sure. The role of women in the AIDS crisis, of straight women and of queer women, I think has not been addressed as much as it should be. And so many of the people I was talking to were women who had, there were women who, they had one close friend who died. There were women who, for instance, worked in the dance world, and they are losing dozens of friends. They are caring for dozens of friends. They are someone who's, especially when it was queer women, the least likely people to get sick. Mm. And yet, banding together. Really interesting things happening between the gay community and the lesbian community in Chicago, which, as in many cities, had not previously gotten along very well. Mm. And the lesbian community stepping in with activism, with volunteering, with care, in profound ways that then, you're in the middle of this, the last person you think to take care of is yourself. You're not going to spend your time and your money going to therapy to deal with this. You're just going to keep caring. And what happens to you long term? Mm. Yeah.
Terrific. Thank you so much for your question there. I think there was a question down here in the seats. Yes.
Hello. Before living in Sydney, we both lived in Chicago for 7 years and in Lakeview for most of it. And I just kind of wanted to know about the inspiration of the space of Boys Town. I could really see the streets. I was wondering if that house that Yale loved so much was real.
Yeah.
So if you could just speak to that a little
Thank you. Yeah. So, I think you caught up. Boys Town is exactly what it sounds like. It's a wonderful neighborhood. And it's a place where, I've always, liked that neighborhood. I don't live in the neighborhood. But it was, there was something really wonderful about the more I learned about the history of that part of town, being able to walk through the streets. And partly I was looking at, what was there now. Partly I had this mental map that grew and grew of where certain bars had been, where certain events had taken place, where people are telling me, this guy, he had his law office on this corner and he did this. And then partly the fictional places that I'd picked out for my characters. So I had an apartment that I've never been inside that I picked out for Yale to be living in at the beginning. And then this beautiful little house down the street that's kind of tucked in between a couple of other apartment buildings. You can take a walk on Google Street View if you want, and you can find it. There are two different ones. So you can pick whichever one you think it is. But it became so wonderfully real to me. And I think it's one of the things that allowed my characters to feel very real is I was hearing real stories. This happened on these streets. Mm. And I'm telling myself these stories of fictional things that happened on those streets, but I'm walking down the streets and it's a big muddle. Also things like, I was writing about this protest in 1990 that happened downtown. I was watching YouTube footage of it, old video footage of it. And you know, it was a real thing that actually happened, and I can see the ledge that these guys stepped out on, but my fictional characters were down there in the street. It utterly transformed Chicago for me. But writing about a very real place, it had challenges in that I needed to, you know, I made a decision, I made a commitment early on to absolutely granular realism. So anything that I wrote about, I needed to be able to research. It still bothers me that I could not figure out, I'm serious, the layout of the upstairs bathrooms at the restaurant Ann Sather in the 1980s.
Wow.
It really bothers me, and I tried so hard. Because, you know, like, that's the kind of thing where if you get it wrong, it could take some, they're like, that's not what it was like. But I figured that if no one could remember, I was okay. But
okay, that's very telling of the kind of research that's been invested into this novel. We've probably got time for one more question, and there's one just there in the third row up.
One of the implications of the novel, because of the three time periods, is the illusion of security. You know, you have this sense of the loveliness of the art scene in Paris before the war, and the reflection of that, those happy times in Chicago or in any big city at the beginning of the 80s for the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. And then there's Paris. Mm-hmm. But each one gets kind of blown up. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the question is that was the choice of 2015 for Fiona's visit to Paris dependent on the Bataclan massacre and the terrorist attacks?
It's a great question.
Because if you'd chosen any other year, the novel would have ended in safety.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's a great question.
And the attacks do feature.
So small spoiler, you know, it's 2015, and I do it so that you actually don't know what season it is. I'm actually very, you haven't spoiled anything for anyone, don't worry. But I was very careful to, the weather was cool, but I never say what season it is so that you're not instantly thinking the whole time, oh my gosh, this must be about to happen. What happened? No, I was writing the fall of 2015 in the fall of 2015. I was trying to write it as contemporary as I could, and I liked that idea of an exact 30-year span. We started in the fall of 85, it's going to be the fall of 15. And I was staying at an artist's residency, a place where you can go and work for a few weeks on your work. I was spending every day, because the Fiona sections were added later, I was really just working on Fiona's sections and kind of trying to keep up. You know, I'm going to write a day in Paris every day here. And I was spending my time in Google Street View, dropping the little blue dude into the streets and walking him around, and you can look off the bridges, and you can, and that's when the terror attacks happened. And I basically stopped working on her sections. I was upset for one thing, obviously, but also just, I don't know how to deal with this. And started to think, okay, when I get back to this, do I move it? Do I move it into 2016? Of course, then 2016 happened, and there's no way these characters are going to be talking anything but politics, and I did not want to introduce that into my book. And in the spring of 2016, Paris was flooded. I didn't want to deal with that. Do I move it back? But then it's not 30 years. And ultimately, I realized this was what I needed. I realized, you know, this is a novel about the intrusions of the chaos of the world into the lives of people who were just trying to live their life. That it would be false in some way to take it out. And that, as you said, you know, just thematically, I didn't want everything to be tied up. And now we're in Paris and it's so beautiful. Let's all move here and we'll have coffee every day. And it's gonna be, you know, it was more, this is the world. The world has shown itself to me for what it is. And that's the world I'm going to represent in the book. Mm.
Thank you so much for your question. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Could you please join me in thanking our wonderful guest today, Rebecca Mackay?
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.